This is Cincinnati Edition. I'm Mark Haney. If you look at the list of companies with their headquarters or significant operations based here, Cincinnati is a serious place to do business. And there are 9 companies in Cincinnati that made the Fortune 500 list. Joining us to talk about the local business scene are Steve Watkins with the Cincinnati Business Courier and financial advisor Chris DeSimio. And you can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Steve and Chris, good to see you this afternoon.
Thanks for having us.
Always great to be here.
Yeah, I was impressed, Steve. 9 companies on the Fortune 500 list. Who are those companies?
Yeah, it's amazing. Cincinnati is really highly represented on that list, much more so than our city size would indicate. The companies, a few are household names, you know, Kroger, P&G, Macy's, Fifth Third Bank Corp. Those are ones that probably come to people's minds right off the top of their heads. But there are some other big ones that people might not think about as much. Omnicare, a pharmaceutical company. Ashland, which used to be the oil company, is now a specialty chemical company. American Financial Group, Carl Lindner's company, is a big downtown insurer. That they're on the list. General Cable is probably the least well-known, and AK Steel, now based in Westchester. They're on the list, too. So, yeah, we've got very great representation.
How about Cintas?
Cintas doesn't quite make it. Another one that was very close. In fact, I'd have to go back and look. I think Cintas is on what they call the Fortune 1000. They actually list 1,000 companies, but that 500 is kind of where the prestige is. Another one that has been on for, I think, every year for a decade is Western and Southern.
Right, because it was 10 last year, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And it's been, I think it's been 10 for a few years, and they barely missed. And they talked about some issues with low interest rates making it tough for them to sell annuities. And they said, hey, we could have probably increased our revenue a little bit, but it would have been at pretty high risk. And they're a fairly conservative company, rightly so. So they kind of barely missed the making the list. But yeah, as you said, we've had 10 in the past, and that's great.
And even though Western and Southern missed, Steve, they still had a great year, didn't they?
Oh, yeah. They had a record year in terms of profitability, and some of their other measures of revenue that aren't quite the same as how Fortune magazine counts it, they set records. Their assets under management are at a record high, too. So, yeah, the company's doing great.
Yeah, of course, they're more than just the insurance side. They own that asset management, Washington.
Fort Washington
mm-hmm. Investment Advisors. And that's what's happening with a lot of these companies. You know, many years ago, if you looked at the Fortune 500 list and you asked the average person, well, which company is bigger in terms of sales? P&G or Kroger? Actually, at the time, Kroger was a bigger company in terms of revenues.
Kroger still is. And you're right. That's a surprise, I think, to most people. That it's funny. If you go by market capitalization, which is just taking the stock price times the number of shares out there, P&G is way bigger.
$216 billion in size versus Kroger at about, not that big.
Yeah. Yeah. Probably a tenth of
$24 billion.
Uh-huh. Yeah. There you go. For sales, you're right. Kroger is just a little bit bigger, a little bit being a few billion dollars. But when you're talking about $90 and $100 billion numbers, and the business lends itself that way. The grocery business generates a lot of revenue, very tight profit margins.
You know, it's interesting, too, that time was that if you said the name of a publicly traded company, everybody in town and even a lot of people who were not in town would know, well, who's the CEO? Oh, you know, and who's the CFO? But there's been a good deal of turnover in some of these corporate suites. Wouldn't you say this year has been more so than others?
Yeah, it seems like it, especially among some of the big ones. I mean, Kroger had David Dillon retired at year end. Rodney McMullen took over. P&G last year, A.G. Lafley came back. Bob McDonald was out. So there are our two biggest companies, and they've had turnover in the past year. And a couple of the others, the ones that we mentioned, Omnicare has had a couple of changes the last few years in terms of their CEO. Looking down the list, I think most of the other ones have stayed pretty stable. But, you know, when you're talking about 9 or 10 of the biggest companies, that's a fair amount of turnover.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation with Steve Watkins from the Cincinnati Business Courier. Steve, forgive me, did you mention Macy's in the list of
Yes, that's Macy's, I think, is the third biggest locally. Yeah. Yeah. So that, and they're, you know, I think sometimes people forget they're based here, because it's such a widely known national company. And,
because the affiliation with Bloomingdale's, so you think New York, but no, they're right here.
Yeah. And the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade is in New York and all that. But yeah, their headquarters are right there on 7th Street, about a block from our offices and about a block or block and a half from the downtown office at Fountain Place.
Yeah. It's hard to believe it happened, but about 22 years ago, Macy's was then known as Federated Department Stores. The ticker was FD, and they had just emerged from Chapter 11 bankruptcy after having gone through that process after being purchased by a real estate developer from Canada named Robert Campo. Now, that's going way back.
Was it the origin Shillitoe's originally?
I believe so. And they owned Reich's up in Dayton. They had stores all over the place.
And then Lazarus. I always get confused. There's always one in between that I forget, but I know it was Shillitoe's and Lazarus, and eventually we ended up with Macy's.
Then it became Macy's. And I remember those days when it was Federated. So I guess that shows you how long I've been around as well.
Yeah.
You know, we can focus on the larger companies that have headquarters here in Cincinnati, but there's also a remarkable number of companies with significant operations here in Cincinnati. They might not be headquartered here, but they're still doing some kind of a major operation. And also a lot of companies that have just a huge international scope.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, General Electric is one of the biggest ones that come to mind. It's one of the biggest companies in the country, and they've got a huge operations here with their aircraft engines division. But yeah, there are quite a few companies like that. I mean, Delta Airlines, you know, they've cut back, but they're still huge out at the airport here. And there are a number of those companies that are on the near the very top of that Fortune 500 list, and you know, several of the big banks.
Ford, for example.
Ford is big here. Chase, J.P. Morgan,
sure.
Chase Bank is big here. So.
What's happening, Steve, with, and you've done a lot of coverage of this, with General Electric looking for a place to put all those people coming to town? There were three candidates, three potential sites. Has that been narrowed down any yet?
I think officially, as far as I know, it hasn't. And I don't know specifically if unofficially it has, although I'm guessing it's in that process right now. Definitely the city leaders here are really pushing for that bank site. I mean, that would do a few things. One, it would bring a lot of jobs downtown, but it would also help develop the banks. They've really been trying to get an office tenant there.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would be good on several fronts. But Mason and I think Oakley are the other ones that are kind of also trying to get it. So, you know, it'll be a great thing for the city no matter how it turns out. But certainly there are some areas that, you know, I think that, you know, when you've got the whole city of Cincinnati pushing for maybe the bank site, Mason's done a great job up there too. And it's sort of funny that you've got different regions of the city kind of competing with each other.
Who would have thought that?
Yeah.
Who would have thought that?
You know, and that's the thing we run into a lot of times with across state lines too, obviously, with Kentucky, where, you know, we're kind of fighting each other internally to try to get something and not getting this regional cooperation we keep talking about.
Yeah, but the thing about Cincinnati, the entire area, is it's so diverse as far as the types of businesses that we have here, because you have an amazing array. You have banking, you have insurance, you've got retailing, you've got technology. I mean, it's a pretty endless list. Any kind of business you can imagine is being done in this city.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I write about the economy every month at least once from the standpoint of the job numbers when they come out. And our unemployment level just last month hit 5%, which is the lowest it's been since before the recession. I mean, that's almost like a back to normal, pre-recession number, really. And, one of the things that economists talk about all the time locally is that we are so diverse, like you said, that we're not reliant on just the auto industry or just the steel industry or things like that. And we're so diverse that, when we get these, when the economy goes bad, we don't suffer it as much. But when it rebounds, you know, if the rebound is fairly broad-based, we really get the benefit of it. So it's a great insulator to any real big downturn.
You know, 5% unemployment, at one time that would have been considered full employment, wouldn't it?
Pretty much, 4.5, 5. If you remember, there was a statistic called NARU, not to be confused with the jackets, but the non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment, NAIRU. And if you remember back when unemployment was around 4, 4.5, the concern was that, my gosh, if if employment continues to stay strong, then wages are going to have to start going up, mm-hmm. which is not a bad thing if you're a wage earner. But if you're trying to keep costs down, then employment costs are such a huge input. And so it's hard to believe, but it's true that Cincinnati is at that, it's kind of brushing up against that non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment.
Yeah, yeah, it is. And granted, it's 1 month. I mean, it came down, I can't remember, about 0.5% or so from like 5.5%. And, you know, those numbers, they're not seasonally adjusted, and they do tend to fluctuate a bit. And I think seasonal, it is a strong point in the season for employment and for unemployment. You know, if that continues for a while, you're right. I mean, we could be back to those times, you know, back in the late 90s, this market was to the point where people were struggling to find workers. And as you said, they had to pay people more, and they were looking outside the city to try to bring in talent because you just couldn't find workers. Everybody already had a good job.
Yeah.
Steve, does the rest of the country see Cincinnati as a big headquarters city? Because I kind of get the feeling that not many people in Cincinnati realize that's the case themselves.
I think that's true. I talked to one investment advisor yesterday about that, and he said, you know, we sell ourselves short a lot in that sense. I think people around the country do not really think of us automatically that way. And it's kind of good with these things like the Fortune 500 list to sort of point out not only to us but to the nation that, hey, we've got a lot going on here. It's one of the big selling points when people try to recruit, either somebody like P&G tries to recruit people, or we try to recruit as a city companies to move here, is, hey, we've got a strong corporate base, and that's good for a lot of things like the arts, sports teams, all that sort of stuff.
Sure.
But one of the things that this advisor told me yesterday too was that locally we sort of sell ourselves short, that he pointed out that a lot of these companies are very successful, and he doesn't think it's any accident that the city is very conducive to companies succeeding, doing good business.
We will continue our conversation with Steve Watkins after the break, and if you'd like to join the discussion, you can call 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, and we're continuing our conversation with Steve Watkins from The Business Courier. If you'd like to join us, the number to call, 513-419-7100. How does Cincinnati stack up against other cities, Steve, when it comes to its business environment?
Well, it seems like we do pretty well, actually. There are different magazines nationally that will do rankings. There's a magazine called Site Selection Magazine, and the city seems to rank really highly generally in terms of best places to do business. I know in Ohio, certainly John Kasich's been very aggressive about trying to get companies here, some from just across the river, which locally may not help us that much if we've got a company in, you know, Covington or Newport and comes to Cincinnati. It doesn't really change the region that much. But, that thought process, I think, does make a difference when we're competing with, let's say, Texas, which we do a lot of times, or, you know, just various markets around the country. So it seems like they are trying to make things like taxation and, financial benefits and things like that more conducive to business here. And I do get the feeling that we compete pretty strongly in most cases.
You know, and it's not just Cincinnati in and of itself. There's also, regionally, there seems to be a lot going on. What do you make, Steve Watkins, at the Business Courier, of Dayton's emergence as an attractant of new jobs with the P&G effort going on up there and others? They've been pretty aggressive too. Home of course, the UD Flyers.
I'm sure you have no connection to that.
University of Dayton.
Let's get the disclaimer in. Well, what year did you graduate now?
Gold medal class of 1979.
Okay, 1982. So.
Oh, so I am outnumbered here. Well, that's okay. I mean, you guys made the Elite Eight in basketball this past year, so we have plenty for you guys to crow about. But also in the business world, now Dayton, as you probably know, has really hit on hard times the last several years with some of the company companies closing and leaving and plant closings and stuff like that. And I'm sure that's why they have been aggressive and things like this, you know, because they need to replace all that. And I think things like P&G opening this or planning to open this new distribution center, I think it is in Dayton, will help Dayton, obviously, because it'll bring a lot of jobs there. It also helps P&G. They've talked a lot about being more efficient, and I think there's been talk about them maybe consolidating some of that distribution, and the fact that they're doing that in Dayton, it may be to the detriment of some of their other locations around the country, but it's great for here, and it's great for P&G, too. I mean, definitely the market loves it when companies cut costs. I mean, that we saw that with Fifth Third the other day, too. I wrote something about them having cut 1,000 jobs from their branches in terms of tellers. That they added 200 in salespeople, but they had a net 800 job cut, and that's because their ATMs are so highly automated now that they don't need as many tellers. People aren't going to tellers as much, and the market loved that. You know, it's not great if you're an employee there, but the investors love that, and that stock went up as a result.
Yeah, there's another good sign for Dayton recently. A Chinese company, I believe, is revamping Moraine for, I believe, glass manufacturing, that kind of thing.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And it doesn't surprise me that there's a lot of that going on in Dayton because, you know, in some ways it's somewhat reminiscent of how Norwood rebuilt itself after the GM plant closed. I mean, that was a couple of decades ago, but it's the same kind of deal where when you've got to replace these jobs, you really can be aggressive in going around. You know, it's not hard to get community support for, hey, let's give tax incentives, let's give whatever we need, but we've got to get some of these jobs going again.
And it's amazing how many other communities have done the same kind of thing. Speaking of General Motors, they had a joint venture with Toyota maybe 25 years ago or so out in Fremont, California, where they built the Nova, which they tried to sell that in south of the border, and it didn't work so well because in Spanish, Nova means it doesn't go.
No go. Yeah.
No go. So they had to kind of rethink their strategy there. But that plant closed around the time of General Motors bankruptcy filing about 5 years ago. And guess what's being made in that very same place now?
What is it?
Tesla.
Oh, well.
Because you had this empty space. And Elon Musk said, you know, I could probably use that.
Uh-huh. In the new economy. Yeah, yeah. That's great.
Steve, you recently wrote about the U.S. Bank Arena, which that's been in the news because local officials cited it as one of the reasons they withdrew Cincinnati from contention for the GOP convention. And it's due for some upgrades this summer from what I read in your article. And what's that revolve around?
Yeah, it is interesting for me looking into it, and I think to a lot of people, I did get a lot of feedback about that story. They're planning about $4 million in renovations this summer. A lot of it has to do with adding higher price seats on the floor, and I asked them, the people that run U.S. Bank Arena, Kristen Ropp, the general manager, who I've talked to for years about the arena and the Cyclones. She's also the general manager of the Cyclones hockey team there. And she talked to me about a lot of these concerts. The performers base a lot of their decisions on how many high-priced seats are available. You know, how much can we sell? You know, if there are more seats in the rafters, that's okay. But if they can sell maybe 1,000 more very high-priced tier one seats is what they call them, then they might be more likely to come here. So they're doing things like that, and they're improving. They're adding two permanent locker rooms. It'll give them four. And that's what the NCAA requires to get a men's college basketball regional tournament here, you know, so we could have postseason basketball here, which we haven't had in 20 years, a little more than 20 years. And those are some of the things that, you know, we're missing out on as a city right now. And part of it's because of the arena. They do a great job running that arena, but it's 39 years old right now. It's practically 40 years old. And we're surrounded by cities, and most of the country's this way, too, at this point. But we're surrounded by cities with very new arenas built in the last 10 years. The Yum Center in Louisville, Nationwide Arena in Columbus.
The Bankers Life Arena in Indianapolis.
Bankers Life Fieldhouse in Indianapolis. And those places, Chris, you and I talked last week about that. You walk in those places and immediately, I mean, you get a far different feel than what you get from U.S. Bank Arena. They just didn't build arenas like that back 40 years ago.
So the question is, I guess you touched on this in the article. One of the questions is upgrade or start all over again with a new arena.
Yeah. And what a lot of people talk to me about is that, you know, there were a couple of people that said we could spend $100 million on renovating that. We being the arena is privately owned. And there is a benefit to that in that, hey, as taxpayers, we didn't pay for it. And so that's good. But the idea is if the owners don't want to pay $100 million to renovate it, and they very well might not, you know, is it worth the city kicking in some money? That might be the case. But a couple people told me, even at $100 million, it's probably still not going to be up to the level of any of these other surrounding city arenas that we talked about that have been built, you know, in the last 10, 12 years. And then you think, well, is there even a point in trying to renovate it? I have to think that's very true, that if you try to renovate it, it's still going to be a 40-year-old arena that just looks a little better. And if you build one from scratch, it probably costs you $250 million or more, but you're going to have something that isn't just short of all these other ones that we're never going to catch up to, but would actually be ahead of the other cities. We'd start getting big name acts in here, NCAA tournaments, you know, a lot of other things, maybe be more competitive for things like a Republican convention that just came up recently.
Yeah, I think one of the figures that was Commissioner Greg Hartman threw out, you know, they're talking about $4 million. I think he said it needs $20 million.
That was
the number that he threw out there. So I guess the $4 million is just a starting point?
Yeah, well, and that's what they've talked about doing at this point. You know, the $20 million is maybe what they needed to do for the to get the convention. But even that, you know, I think there's another level at which they're going to have to upgrade it if they really want to be competitive with some of these other cities and other arenas that are around us.
So even if they make some minor improvements, though, even if they don't spend $20 million, whatever they do, upgrading it's going to mean a big boost for the local economy and local development.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it doesn't hurt. You know, and the last time that arena was upgraded in any significant way, I think, was the late 90s when the Cyclones moved back down here from the Gardens. So, you know, that's been 15 years ago now. So it definitely needs some upgrades. And the fact that they are putting money into it is a good thing for the city. It probably will help get some other concerts and things like that. But there is a bigger picture issue to, you know, are we still going to be trying to compete with a 40-year-old arena, or are we going to really get some momentum behind developing something new that maybe, let's say, UC basketball could play in? There has been some talk of them moving down to US Bank Arena, but it doesn't sound like they're all that fired up about doing that.
It is interesting, too, to think. If you remember, let's roll the tape back about 15 years. The Bengal Stadium was being built, and no one was quite sure where the baseball stadium would go. It was going to go up there at Broadway Commons. And do you remember the name of the location on the Banks, what's now known as the Banks, what it was going to be called, because it was going to be squeezed in? Remember that?
Yeah, sure. It was the Wedge.
The Wedge. It was going to be wedged in there.
Yep, kind of like a salad wedge.
Yeah, exactly.
Probably not as tasty.
Exactly.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. After the break, you know, politicians are going to behave a certain way when the midterm elections roll around. Did you know that markets behave a certain way, too? And in Focus on Technology, a Cincinnati man's invention is helping schools, parents, and businesses connect. You can join our conversation at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Continuing our conversation with financial advisor Chris DeSemio, also Steve Watkins from The Business Courier, and Mark Motley with the financial planning and portfolio management firm Foster & Motley. He's our guest in the studio. And you can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100. You can email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Chris, this has been a pretty big week for numbers, hasn't it?
It always is.
That first week.
The first week.
This one seems more intense than usual.
It is, and I think it's because of the recent rally that we've had, especially in some of the names which had been clocked so thoroughly, and now we have the market at all-time highs. So here are these numbers, and we have a new Fed chairperson. There was a story earlier this week about she's spoken publicly now about six times, and five of those, the market's gone up. So people are trying to, you know, bet. We got the Belmont Stakes coming up, of course, this weekend, too. People are trying to place their money ahead of what she's going to say. So it is an interesting. We've got a boatload of numbers this morning. Of course, it's all a prelude to the first-time claims for unemployment insurance tomorrow, which is, again, a prelude for Friday's big number, the jobs report. But this morning, the numbers were not really great, and the market was pretty weak in the morning. The ADP report, which is seen as it's a private company that does the payrolls, and that number was expected to be, you know, around 210,000 new jobs, only 179,000 new jobs. We got a look this morning at the non-farm productivity. It was people that weren't looking for a lot anyway there, but it fell more than expected. And we've been talking about inflation lately. Unit labor costs were expected to be up 5.2%. They rose 5.7%. So all in all, not a great – I mean, there was a lot of data, but very little of it was good. And yet, after – initial weakness this morning, the market's now trading up about 15, 16 points.
We got the ISM number, though. I think that's what swung things.
That's right.
Good ISM number.
Exactly. ISM's, the Institute for Supply Management number was a little better than expected.
I think it was the best it's been in 9 months. And then also the 53rd straight month that the index has been above 50.
50 is the...
Which is where you want it to be, is above 50.
Exactly. Anything below 50 indicates that the economy is losing... You know, is contracting, and anything above 50 means expansion.
Okay, and it seems in this case the market's paying more attention to that ISM number.
Well, it's one of those numbers that's considered to have more leading indicators than the leading economic indicator figure itself. That LEI number comes out once a month. I think it's a conference board that does it. And most of the numbers that are in that data set are already known. They have like 9 of the 10 inputs already. So there's very little surprise usually in the leading economic indicators. But the ISM number is fresh data. It may not be high-frequency data like one of these weekly numbers, but it's still pretty good. But that number, would you like the number?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, sure. I just happen to have it.
Interesting.
Yeah. The consensus was looking for 55.3, and it came out at 56.3.
Okay.
Isn't that – so pretty
so well above 50.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, the S&P keeps making new highs every time I turn around.
Yes, it does. And so – and the Dow Industrials are at that level as well. And that's been a big cause of concern because here we are. We're back again. The market's at all-time highs. Does this mean that we're at one of these – is it a ceiling or will it become a new floor if things go better? And that's why we have such smart people in the room here with us.
That's right. I'd be curious what their opinions is on this because it seems like that it's making new highs, but it's never by huge amounts. It's always by a few points here or a few points there. So is that something that, you know, as this little individual investor, I'm putting my money away. Should I be worried about that?
Oh, we should always be worried about things. it's when you don't worry that trouble is about to happen. And this is why it's great. I mean, and Mark's been kind enough to come in. Mark's a chartered financial analyst, which is one of the hardest designations to get. And his firm recently recognized, in fact, Steve Watkins wrote about this in the Business Courier, as one of the 100 best fee-only financial planning firms in the whole country.
Thanks.
Thanks, Mark.
Appreciate it. Good to be here.
So – what are you doing right now then? Are you, as Mark said, on behalf of your clients, are you saying, look, folks, we're at a top, take some chips off the table or just move the chips over to a different part of the table because there are other places that are going to be doing better? What's your firm strategy at this particular time?
We certainly don't know how to do that. And the 15 point up or the 100 point up or whatever that we're talking about, the little moves don't make, you know, it's easy to get caught up in the detail but to step back and look at the big picture, you know, we have a situation, well, the S&P was up 32% last year. I just came from a presentation, Bob Arnott was speaking and he talked about that and he asked the room, why do you think that was? Do you think it was because robust, wonderful economic growth and no hands went up, of course. Was it because we have wonderful, you know, policies from the government laying groundwork for future growth, no hands. Was it possibly because there was $1 trillion of bonds bought by the Federal Reserve? Everyone, of course. So we had this artificial environment, artificial demand for financial assets. So that means that prices are, we don't know how much, but prices are higher than they otherwise would be. And so there is some reason for caution with that. We don't know when they're still, you know, doing that. They're tapering it off, but they're still doing it. So there's no reason to basis, we think, for forecasting how that's going to change in the near term. But we think a little bit longer term, there is some reason for risk because of that, some concern for that risk.
Mark, what message do you think the bond market is sending? Because I think expectations were for it to do one thing, but it's been doing the complete opposite.
Yeah. Well, lately, the bond market and the stock market have sort of gotten on different tracks. The bond market is acting like the economy is going to be getting weaker and the stock market's looking the other way and we don't know how it's going to be resolved yet.
It really is interesting. And of course, the whole financial planning world has been undergoing dramatic change. Used to be not that long ago that people would listen to the radio all the time to get a stock market report at the end of the day. Well, no one does that anymore because you just pull out your smartphone and or look at it throughout the day. There's information everywhere, and yet there seems to be a growing need for people who can help investors process that information and make it something that's personal to them. And of course, Steve, at the Business Courier, you've done a lot of work covering the asset management scene, you know, both locally and nationally. What's your sense of how firms such as Mark's, which he runs with his partner, Dave Foster, Foster Motley, are these firms growing just here in Cincinnati, or is this something that's part of a larger?
I think it's part of a larger trend. I've talked to quite a few firms, and Mark, I'm sure you guys are seeing this too, that a lot of firms have said their assets are growing significantly. And I think the reason is, I'm sure there's a lot of reasons for it, but one of the big things seems to be that a lot of people, especially after the big market crash in 08 and 09, really got frightened and felt like, hey, this isn't something I can just do on my own and forget about it. During the good times, they probably could. In the late 90s, I mean, heck, anybody could make money then in the market. But now I do get the feeling that a lot of people are worried about preserving their assets and trying to figure out, often overthinking, should I be in the market or not? I was talking to somebody just earlier today. We were talking about how many people missed this whole recovery because they were so afraid to get in the market after 08 and 09. And of course, it's, as we talked about, it's hit new highs. And a lot of these people have stayed in cash that whole time. And so they lost money going down, and then they didn't get any of the rebound because they sold out. I mean, is that something you guys have at least heard of? I'm sure your clients haven't done that.
But that's certainly a factor, but I think at least as big is another factor, simple demographics. People are retiring. Baby boom is retiring rapidly. And in many, many cases, the moment that someone suddenly has a lot of money that it's got to be taken care of, got to be managed, more than they've been comfortable with, is when they retire. And so they're often looking for help at that point.
You have done a lot of work, and it's available at your website. You've written about China, among other things. And earlier we were speaking off, Mike, about work you've done that highlights or sheds some light on how financial markets behave and what investors should be doing in these midterm election years. I wish I could express to our listeners just how broadly Mark is grinning now, because I can't tell if it's a grin or a smirk. What should we be looking for?
It was your comment, the sort of teaser comment before about how markets behave
or misbehave
during midterm elections.
Politicians are going to do that.
Unfortunately, it's not nearly that predictable a pattern, but there's a tendency, and we didn't discover this. This has been widely known that there's a quarterly seasonality to markets, and the first and fourth quarters tend to be best on average in the long run. Lots of exceptions to this. And the second and third quarters tend to be worse than average. And in fact, so much worse than average that the return, if you just invest in those quarters all the way back, is only slightly positive. And so that's out there. And then separately, there's this issue of a 4-year market cycle.
The presidential
election cycle. And when you put those two together, it turns out, and also we didn't do this, when you put those two together, it turns out that the quarterly cycle, virtually all of that occurs within one of these 4 years, this one here, the midterm election year cycle. So it's strongest in this period. What we did was we overlaid on top of that valuation, and we just used the Robert Shiller's PE10 or CAPE10.
This is the recently recognized with the Nobel Prize winning Robert Shiller, who correctly called the top in the real estate market back in 2005 or 6.
Yeah. And he's probably more famous from his real estate indexes, actually. They get published or talked about every month. But in any event, we simply overlaid that and found that was a big discriminator in the half of the markets when the market was highest and the half when they were was the cheapest going into that period. It was a big discriminator. And on average, going back, about a 10% total return decline over the 6 months in the second and third quarter in midterm election years when the market was expensive, in the upper half of being expensive. The return was actually pretty significantly, way off the average, about minus 10, which says nothing necessarily about what's going to happen this time. You know, it's always different. And this time we've got this big Federal Reserve doing massive things, and maybe it won't work out that way. But there is a tendency towards a correction in this sort of environment.
Well, it's been an awful long time, has it not, since we've had a 10% pullback? I mean, on the average, a 5% pullback about once every 4 months or so.
Sure.
10% on the average about once every 11 months, maybe. It's been a while.
Year or so. And it could be another year before that ever happens. But we think the odds are stacked against a huge run from here and favor a little bit of a correction. So we're on the cautious side.
Are you guys doing anything in terms of asset allocation along those lines? You know, are you cutting back at all? Are you telling clients anything that relates to that?
I hesitate to speak about that because it's such a departure from what we've ever done and because the scale of it has been so small. But yes, we did. Now, it turns out that it's about a 3.5% swing, a little less than that in the aggregate. So it's not a big thing, but we actually have taken a little bit of a swing away from stocks to cash. Mm-hmm.
So is it fair to say, Mark, that in general, around a midterm election, there's market weakness going on?
In general, the second and third quarters of midterm election years, when market starts off high at the beginning of that period, has there's a strong tendency for markets to be a little negative. Now, interestingly, just a couple of times when conditions were that way, that it was up. It was only up 4 and 5%. So it was a real strong pattern. The reason that I say all this with a strong caution is that it's a very small statistical sample. We go back to 1925, and it seems like a lot of year, but you only get every fourth year, and then you take just half of those because of valuation, and we're talking about a pretty small
maybe
sample
10,
size.
Maybe
so
10 samples.
11, yeah, 12. And so it is a strong pattern in a very, non-robust sample. And so we've taken a very small tilt with that. So not a big story, unfortunately, but yeah.
What about the bond market? Do midterms elections generally have a similar effect?
That's a good question, and we haven't done that study.
No study's done on that. Okay.
What are you telling your clients now who are looking for income? They've been, crushed owning a series of certificates of deposit that have been renewed at successively lower interest rates. They got bailed out a little bit in the bond market earlier this year. The 10-year treasury yield is now about 2.5 2.5% range. What are you telling clients who are looking for a stream of income? They're retiring 10,000 baby boomers a day hanging it up, and they have to rebuild an income. And so many fewer of them have pensions. What are at Foster & Motley? What are you suggesting people do then?
That is the huge question of the hour. Really, we've got a situation where, as I mentioned, financial assets are artificially inflated, and so what do you want to do? You want to just sort of ride it out and be in cash. But because of this, some advisors have coined the term financial repression for the Federal Reserve. That savers they can't live on CD rates, and so you're forced to invest longer term in assets that you think are somewhat overpriced. And so that's a problem. But all you can really do is just be in it for the long haul and take a very diversified approach and recognize that returns are going to be lower going forward than you wish they would be.
So it's kind of resetting those expectations then.
Yeah.
For investors. Do you have a lot of clients, Mark, who come to you and ask you about local companies or about local IPOs or about local big companies and whether those are good things in which to squirrel away some of their hard-earned nest egg?
Not a lot, but there's a wide range of clients, and some certainly very interested in those topics, yeah.
You know, it's always been fun, too, as an investor. You look at, well, where do you get information that not everyone else would have? And if you go to a website and read posts such as yours or go to the Business Courier. Not, believe it or not, I know, Steve Watkins, this might come as a shock, but not everyone in the country reads the Business Courier yet.
They certainly should, but I'm not surprised they don't all do it.
but there are lots of nuggets of good investment ideas just by reading the news story that go beyond, here's what you should invest in. If you can see all this manufacturing activity, then you may want to look at companies that sell stuff to these people and find out who they are. What kind of interplay do investment firms such as yours, Mark, to what extent do you use local news resources that might kind of be considered off the beaten path in terms of the, you know, it's not Forbes or Fortune or Barron's.
Sure.
How do you use information such as what Mark's, but such as what Steve Watkins at the Business Courier generate?
You know, that's a really good question that would apply to most advisors and not so much to us. And the reason is we're not very news driven. Our research is not traditional research. We're very quantitative. It's by the numbers. We want to try to, our whole approach is to take, is to insert discipline into the process by wringing out emotion and by making it just by, you know, by the numbers driven. So traditional research that would involve sources that other people don't find are not as big, you know, as big a part of what we're doing. And that said, we do some real estate investing and private real estate, and some of these are companies that are around here, and we can follow what's going on with those things in your paper and others easier. But in general, it's not the big driver for us as it is for most other firms.
You use the term discipline. What is the most important discipline that an investor can take with them in the whole thing?
Well, it's to try to master the beast of emotion. And that affects individual investors and it affects institutional investors. People just tend to run in a herd. And when all you hear on the news, you know, imagine, think back to, you know, late 1998, or late 2008. The financial world was falling apart and everyone was panicked and not just scared, but just, well, it's tough to keep your discipline and be a long-term investor then, but that's the time when it's rewarded the most. And so fighting the tendencies to do that when times are bad and to chase after whatever has been hot, to buy the, you know, the market or the fund or the stock that was, you know, that you regretted not owning last year or that all your friends, you know, whatever, to avoid those two big temptations. That's most of the battle. You know, you could probably, Chris, quote this better than I, but the various studies, Dalbar and others, about the investors' realized return in funds, it's so much less than the actual returns posted, and it's because they're moving out at the wrong times and they're moving in at the wrong times and just creating, you know, a lot of headwind. That if you can just eliminate that, that's the best thing you can do.
Yeah. We've met the enemy and he is us. And of course, Steve over there at the Business Courier, you have covered, we don't need to name names, but there have been some amazing, and it almost seems like perpetual financial shenanigans going on with kind of off the beaten path deals that happen where people end up, again, it's the flip side of fear is greed, and the sense of greed is appealed to, and that can also lead to some disastrous consequences.
Definitely. Yeah, it goes back to the point Mark made that, you know, if people can have a lot of discipline in their investing, they probably won't fall for these scams and things that are and end up being illegal. But there have been numerous of those, and they almost always have the one thing in common, that they have this promise of very high returns, often very consistent returns, you know, which goes back to even Bernie Madoff, where he was getting an exact same percentage return every single year, which is impossible. But, you know,
impossible.
If you finagle the numbers enough, I guess you can do it. But yeah, people do get highly greedy, and, you know, it's often to their detriment. Goes back to Mark's point about the emotion of the process. If you can take that out, I'm sure you're better off.
Steve, I'll add another point to that, which is that there's one more thing that isn't common. These things, they never seem to end. They're always coming up. But the lack of a broker custodian, either an in-house broker like a Chris's firm, Morgan Stanley, or an independent broker, they never have that. They are their own custodian, and that's, if you could avoid that, that's half of the, most of the battle, frankly.
Yeah. We talked, several months ago, I think back in the summer on this show, we talked to one of the regulators at the state, and yeah, that was one of the points that they've talked about, is you do have that protective layer, like you said, of, you know, if there's an outside custodian, they're keeping an eye out on these assets, but when it's all in-house, you don't know what's happening with it.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean they're doing something illegal with it, but you don't have that guarantee that an outsider would have.
Yeah, and Chris DeSimio always laughs at me, you know, talking about emotion.
I don't always laugh at you.
Well, you do. You always will.
Sometimes.
One of my favorite numbers to look at is what, Chris? The VIX, right?
Yes,
I always like to
VIX.
Look at the VIX.
The fear indicator.
Complacency range today.
It is. It's complacency range is a good way to describe it. Does that cause any concern for you?
Oh, yeah. It's just one more of a wide mosaic of things that it just looks like there is more risk than is appreciated in markets right now.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, you know, it's hard to believe that we've now just about gone halfway through the year, a year following a year such as last year where the S&P was up 32%. Here we are. The market's barely up this year, really.
Yeah.
It's been a lot of sideways, up and down.
A few points here, a few points there, a few points here, a few points there. Well, everybody, thanks for joining us this afternoon. We really appreciate it. Mark Motley with Foster & Motley, financial advisor Krista Simeo, and also Steve Watkins from The Business Courier.